Yes. So this is the first midterm, and the second midterm is way, way away. It's a very easy midterm. Basically, we've given you the answers actually on the midterm. As ever, you have to really write concisely and precisely two questions. And the one is really supposed to be a help for the second. The first is supposed to lead up to the second. And actually, this address of Obama has already been the subject of much debate around the very question of inequality. There was a colloquium in the department yesterday that revolved around that. And then there's an article in the New York Times today precisely about what on earth Obama means by inequality. So you're going to have a lot of fun with Marx, Engels, and Durkheim. Yes. Now, I'm not holding any official review sessions, though anybody who wants to ask me questions, I have the seminars on Thursday from 4 to 5:30 in Barrows 420, and any of you can come with questions to that. There'll be one this Thursday, and there'll be one the following Thursday. And let me tell you what's in plan. So basically today I hope to finish Organic Solidarity. It is the most difficult of all the classes probably on Durkheim is today. And then next time we will do book two, chapter two, with a bit of a few pages extra. And that will be about the transition from organic solidarity to, from mechanical solidarity to organic solidarity and the rise of the division of labor. And then next week we will deal with the abnormal forms, and it is only then that you will be able to see the great significance of Durkheim, in particularly in relationship to the questions here. So it's all leading up. We are building it block by block, brick by brick. And so keep on reading. Yes. Any questions? Yes, Emily. Is there something wrong with my mic? It sounds really funny. Okay.
Well, I don't know what to do.
Does it sound still sound funny? Hello?
Hello.
Oh, you want to hear me? That's the problem. You can't hear me. I don't. I probably because I'm. How about this?
No. I don't know what to do. On my collar, then it won't. Well, we could try. Yeah, I'm trying.
Hello.
Is that better?
No.
Much worse. Nope. Batteries are fine. Well, let's see.
Is that better?
No. I don't know, I think maybe it's something to do with the volume. That maybe. I don't know how to change the volume here. No idea. Well, you don't need the mic anyhow, do you? Is it? Well, if I don't speak, you can hear me at the back. What's your name again? I've already forgotten it. What is it? No, I got Cynthia's in my head. It's yours I haven't got. Jamal, that's right. You'll be my test. Can you hear me?
Very good. Okay.
All right. Yes, all right. So, any questions apart from my mic? Okay, right. Good. So, as I said, if you have any questions about Durkheim, you want to ask me Thursday and Thursday. Okay, is there anything else I should be saying? Nope. Okie dokie. Very good. So, for next time, Thursday, read book two, chapter two, and pages 118 to 123, which is all about what happens to the collective consciousness under organic solidarity. Summary! Summary. All right. Look, the question in the book is the division of labor good or not? How is he going to figure this out? Well, he's going to figure it out scientifically, not philosophically, scientifically. He's going to figure this out by comparing the division of labor, which is something that is unquestionably good. Solidarity. That's the first assumption. Solidarity is an unquestionable good. Well, okay, how's he going to figure this out? Well, he says there are two types of solidarity, mechanical solidarity, organic solidarity. And we've got to figure out which is corresponds to the division of labor. Well, it's very simple. The division of labor corresponds to organic solidarity. But you can't measure solidarity. You have to measure it indirectly. So you measure it through, and this is the second assumption, through laws. And what he says is there are two types of laws, repressive laws and restitutive laws, corresponding to mechanical solidarity and organic solidarity. And what he's going to argue is that as the division of labor develops, restitutive laws increase relatively in number to repressive laws, and that will indicate that the solidarity in society is responsible, division of labor is responsible for the solidarity in society, this organic solidarity based on interdependencies. But he says, and this is what we'll come to next week, he says, well, in fact, it turns out there's a lot of conflict in society. And well, that means, he says, that division of labor is still in an abnormal form. And we have to wait yet for it to receive its true normal form. And under those circumstances, we will have solidarity. And the key to the whole book in the end turns out to be, what are the conditions for a normal division of labor? What are the conditions for division of labor to actually produce solidarity? And we will get to that, as I say, next week. So what I want to do now is give you a summary of what I just said with a little picture. We haven't had many pictures, but we're going to have one today. And it's a biggish picture. And it's going to go, well, it's got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 columns. And I'm going to see if I can get it on here. There's 3 and 2 rows. Okay. We're going to start at the top with mechanical solidarity, which is based on what? Similarities, likenesses. Right. And what he says on page 60, where he begins to actually compare the two forms of solidarity directly, he says on page 6, everybody got their books here? Anybody not got their book yet? Anybody still waiting for Amazon to sell you, send you your book? Alisa, where are you? There you are. You got it? Oh, so beautiful. All right, everybody. Mario. Beautiful. You even made the effort. But is it underlined? Let's have a look. Let's have a look. Let's see if you read it. Let's have a look. Chapter 3. Let's have a look. See if I can see any underlinings here. Well, there's something. Repressive law corresponds to what is the heart and center of the common consciousness. Very good. Well, perhaps that's the most important and only important thing in the first 5 pages. Yes. Oh, this is terrible of me, isn't it? Okay. Well, all right. Very courageous. Well, you're going to have to read this very carefully before for the exam. Yes. Okay. Well, at least you have it. That's good. That's progress. Very good. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. All right. Page 60. Page 60. And what I'm going to read there is under section 4, section 4, the second paragraph, 2, 4, 5 lines into it, where Durkheim says, indeed, are you there? Are you there, Mario? Page 60. It's not on your... You didn't Xerox that? You know why I'm picking on Mario? Why am I picking on Mario, Zach? Hmm?
Being sending a message.
Yeah, I don't care about Mario. I just care about everybody else. I'm sending a message. And I've been doing it for how many months? 7 or 8 months. I read my Durkheim and I practiced Durkheim. Yes, right. All right. Zach, why don't you read it out? Page 60, new paragraph. Second new paragraph. Into section 4. And it's the 5 lines into it. Indeed.
Indeed, under these conditions, all members of the group are not only individually attracted to one another.
This is mechanical solidarity. Individually attracted to one another.
Because they resemble one another, but they are also linked to what is the condition for the existence of this collective type. That is, to the society that they form by coming together. Not only do fellow citizens like one another, seeking one another out in preference to foreigners,
right, so it's not only because people like one another, but they also, in a sense, like the collective to which they all belong. Like, you are all the same here, and you are, in fact, individuals. Well, not really individuals, you're all like one another, but totally attached to 102. Yes, that's the idea of mechanical solidarity. Direct links to society. Okay. So, this society based on mechanical solidarity of likenesses has a strong what? This society based on mechanical solidarity is characterized also by a strong... what is your name? Anna, very good. A strong collective consciousness. Strong, actually, he says, it's a strong and well-defined collective consciousness, in which the collective consciousness is much greater than the individual consciousness. Collective consciousness is greater than individual consciousness, much greater. And in fact, in the extreme, there is no individual consciousness. There are individuals, you might say, but we think of ourselves as part of a collective rather than as being individuals. And he says that on page 84. He says that, well, why don't we start at the top, so 2, 4, 6, 8 lines from the top of the page. Let me read it to you. As we have said, there is in the consciousness of each one of us two consciousnesses. There is one that we share in common with our group in its entirety, which is constantly not ourselves, but society living and acting within us. The other that, on the contrary, represents us alone in what is personal and distinctive about us, what makes us an individual. The solidarity that derives from similarities is at its maximum when the collective consciousness completely envelops our total consciousness, coinciding with it at every point. At that point, our individuality is zero. Okay. Now, why does he call it mechanical solidarity? Anybody found a place where he says that? Why does he call it mechanical solidarity? Ariel? You're mumbling. Just tell us without reading. Do you remember what he says there, basically, in your own words?
Like it's an analogy.
It's an analogy to what? Well, what's the analogy to? Well, let's read, okay. The social molecules, last paragraph, that can only cohere in this one manner cannot therefore move as a unit save insofar as they lack any movement of their own. as do the molecules of inorganic bodies. This is why we suggest that this kind of solidarity should be called mechanical. The word does not mean that the solidarity is produced by mechanical and artificial means. We only use this term for it by analogy, as you say, with the cohesion that links together the elements of raw materials in contrast to that which encompasses the unity of living organisms. What finally justifies the use of this term is the fact that the bond that thus unites the individual with society is completely analogous to that which links the thing to the person. So it looks like this. Basically, this is Durkheim's view of inorganic entities. They're full of molecules that all look the same, act the same, and move the same. Now, he didn't know a lot of physics, but that doesn't matter. This is his imagination of mechanical solidarity. Mm-hmm. And then he says that this corresponds to repressive law, in which violation of the law is a crime which leads to punishment, right? Which is then, he says, the idea of punishment is to repair the collective consciousness that has been broken or violated, and the idea of punishment is to act on all people to remind them of their common attachment to these norms of society, values of the collective consciousness, repairing the collective consciousness being broken. And therefore it has to be public, passionate, and organized. Now, we had a wonderful discussion last time about the ways in which repressive law in this society does not necessarily lead to public, passionate, and organized punishment. And we're going to have to think about why that might be the case. But in a small-scale society where the collective consciousness is very strong and there is very weak individuality, then that society, indeed, he claims, punishment is public, punishment and organized. And we have examples of that in our own society. Some examples. Yes. All right. Like this class. Public, passionate and organized. Yes. So, finally, the state. Now, for Durkheim, the state that corresponds to mechanical solidarity, i.e. a solidarity based on a strong collective consciousness, in this society, the state, embodies, expresses, reflects, the collective consciousness. The state is an expression of the collective consciousness. You might say, are there institutions in this society that, in a sense, are an expression of the collective consciousness? You might say the Supreme Court is an expression of the collective consciousness in this society, and how it slowly but surely changes interpretations of laws reflects the changes in the collective consciousness. Yes. And he also says that attacks on the state of any sort are understood to be attacks on the collective consciousness and therefore are punished out of all proportions with the actual crime, because an attack on the state is a direct attack on the collective consciousness. So, for example, flag burning around here is really a big crime, or it can become a crime, because in a sense it is a violation of that national consciousness. And that's why you might say that the strike against the World Trade Center and the Pentagon was a strike against the state that had to be given a very deep, profound, and totally mobilized response. Indeed, there was. It's called what? The War on Terror. Yes. Okay, that is mechanical solidarity. Any questions on that? Yes. So, Nicolette.
If that there's still some repressive law, right? And but does it take the same character as the,
well, that's what we have to figure out. So, as I said, first of all, you're right. Your first premise is absolutely right. The collective conscious never goes away. But it changes its content, as we will see when we read pages 118 and 123. And it does become weaker. Now, what is the content of the collective consciousness today? If we celebrate the collective in small-scale societies, today we celebrate the individual. So the collective consciousness celebrates individuals. So we have an individualistic common consciousness. We all share in the preservation, recognition of the importance of individual human dignity and rights, shall we say. Now, that may have implications, for example, for the character of punishment today as opposed to into a small-scale society. So we may not want to publicly punish people because that, in some sense, may be seen to be in a violation of that collective consciousness that recognizes individual human dignity. So we may want to do it more privately. And we may want to focus more on the trial than on the execution. So we have to think, we have to be very careful when we pick up analogies of mechanical solidarity in present society. We have to recognize it is a society that exists also, and mechanical solidarity exists alongside organic solidarity. And so we have to think. Now, Durkheim doesn't do that thinking for us. He separates the two. But we have to do that. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Good. Yes. Sammy.
Wouldn't laws only reflect like the collective consciousness of the dominant group that are empowered to make the laws?
That is a question that only one person would ask in our readings. That is a question that who would ask? Gramsci, very good, Angelina. Lenin and Marx. Lenin would definitely ask that question. Oh, those laws are to actually contain the irreconcilable antagonisms between classes. And Durkheim says, now, this is the wonder of this class. Completely different vision, right? Durkheim says, no, that laws do not represent a dominant class. They represent the totality. And we can only really evaluate the two perspectives when we get to book three. Because there we will see what are the conditions, amazing conditions, and we'll get to some of them today, amazing conditions for there to be solidarity from the division of labor. It might, for example, turn out, I'm not saying it will, but it might turn out that there are no classes. There are no classes under the division of labor that produces organic solidarity. It might turn out. Yeah, so we hold off. Very, very important question. That's the Marxian question from last semester. Yes. 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 All right. Organic solidarity. Second row. OS. Complementary differences. Complementary differences. Right. Now, what does Durkheim say about these complementary? If here we have direct links to society with organic solidarity, we have what? We have indirect links. Indirect links to society. What does that mean? Anybody tell me what it means when we've got division of labor, organic solidarity? What does it mean to say there are indirect links to society? Yes, Kevin. That is the idea that we are dependent upon one another, and through that interdependence, we are connected to the whole. That you and I are interdependent, and through that interdependence, we are connected to the whole, which is this whole class. Yes. Right. Right. Yes, and you can read all that to some extent on 185. No, sorry, 85. But let's go on. Let's go on. Let's go on. Let's go on. So, let us have a look. So this society here, we have a society now with a division of labor, now, of specialized what? Now, this is very important. Specialized, A, individuals, but also what else? Specialized parts, functions, parts of society. Yes, yes. Individuals and parts. So here we have a situation in which the individual consciousness becomes stronger and stronger relative to the collective consciousness. We now have individuals specializing. Individuals specializing, that's this. Individuals specializing. And as they specialize, they develop an individual consciousness. But the collective consciousness never disappears, changes its form. But we also have a vision of specialization, which looks like this. This is the Spencerian, Durkheimian idea, where the idea of organic solidarity comes from. Because what Durkheim is suggesting is that as society evolves, there is not just a division of labor between individuals, but different parts of society assume different functions. So we have the family, separates from the economy, separates from the state, separates from civil society, to use the vocabulary of last semester. And so what he's going to argue is different parts of society separate out and have specific functions. Let's have a read on that. 85. Yes. Well, there's a lot to read here. All right, I don't want to read. You should read these. 84, 85 are very important. 85, let me read the big paragraph in the middle of page, Anthony, 2, 4, 6 lines from the bottom. This solidarity, organic solidarity. Yes.
This solidarity resembles that observed in the higher animals.
That's you and me.
In fact, each organ has its own special characteristics and autonomy. Yet the greater the unity of the organization...
Organism.
Yet the greater the unity of the organism, the more marked the individualization of the parts. Using this analogy, we propose to call organic the solidarity that is
So, here's a tricky guy, this man. He has two divisions of labor almost. A division of labor of individuals specializing, but also a division of labor specializing of parts in society. Yes. And so he has the analogy here of society like the human body. The human body, also well coordinated. The human body, well coordinated. Mimi. The state doesn't take over, we'll get to that, but the state doesn't take over things, it regulates things, regulates ever more and more. He's having there, as we will see, an argument with Spencer, who says the state shrinks. Durkheim says it gets bigger. So, yeah, we'll get to that in a second. Well, before the end of this class. Yes. Does that satisfy you for now? So, let's think about this. Just think about this. What are the problems? No. What are the limits? What are the limits of the analogy of the human body as society? Society like a human body, different parts. My brain is the state. My heart is the economy. My legs are the family. What's the problem with that sort of analogy? Any ideas? Katie?
Well, maybe by definition they're physically connected to each other.
Nicolette.
Well, you can't change the function of your legs. Your legs are your legs no matter what. So that it's kind of static?
Static, but I can grow a third leg.
No, you can't.
Ah, very good. Interesting. Yeah, interesting, yes. Interesting, kind of static. Well, of course, the claim might be that society is perhaps static too, that there are limits to, you know, to the changes that we experience in society. But yes, you can't talk about... revolutions, right? Can't talk about revolutions. Yes, 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 yes. Yes, so you have difficulty. Yes, that's one. Very good. Yes, where I saw another hand somewhere. Yes, Clinet. Question is, what are the limits?
Okay.
What are the implications of analogizing society to the human body? Well, that's what Katie began saying. You can't separate parts. But and so perhaps in society, do parts of hive off? Do they? Do they? Natalie? It's well coordinated, often. Uh-huh. And society's not like that.
Well, it has its functions, and then there is coordination, but he's saying that they're separate, but the human body, that even the functions themselves are not separate.
Don't get you. No, the question is, perhaps I'm not being clear. The question is, what is it, if we think of society like the human body, what are the implications for the way we study society, way we see society? Think always of last semester. What things can't we talk about, or that you might want to talk about in the future? I mean, or now, but I mean, that you, if you think of society as a human body, yes. Yes, you had your hand up. Yeah.
If one part of the body gets sick,
will not be able to function. May or may not. Uh-huh. Well, that's what happens in society, no? If family gets sick, if all families get sick, if the state gets sick, if the economy gets sick, then we have a problem with society. We've got a problem already with our society, haven't we? Economy is pretty sick. Yes, so that works together, because there are these different parts of society do contribute to the whole in the way that parts of the body contribute to the whole. Yes, Angelina. No, 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 no. This is how it goes. This is how it goes. That's historical evolution. This is mechanical solidarity. This is organic solidarity. Right? Brandon. And in society,
that is not necessary.
True, there can be in society what? Conflict. Very good. Very good. You anticipate my thoughts. Yes. Conflict. You know, it's very difficult to talk about conflict if you have this sort of analogy of a coordinated body of interdependent parts. Conflict. Revolution. Yes, actually, it's also a bit difficult to talk about mobility of individuals. It's not clear where individuals fit into this whole story. Anyway, you will see that this organic analogy spreads through Durkheim. It's a sort of unwritten text in this text. And so beware of the limitations of analogies. Yes. Analogies are very important and very helpful, but they come with limitations sometimes. Any other thoughts about this particular analogy? Yes, Soma.
You also can't talk about the appropriation of who gets what and who makes what, because in the body, the part that's carrying out the function is the one controlling the function.
Yes, I think to talk about exploitation between parts is a bit it's a bit difficult. Yes, it's a bit difficult. It's a bit difficult. Very good. Very good. Very good. Very good. Very good. Very good. Yes. Very good. Yes. Yes, Christina. Who says he doesn't die? That's interesting. Some societies seem to have died. Feudalism, slavery, I mean. Yes, it's very interesting. Is it because once some part of it died? Yeah. Yeah, human bodies perhaps a bit more fragile than society. Yeah, very interesting. So it implies that things, I think that's what you've been saying in the front row here, Nicolette. Yeah, that somehow it continues. There's certain continuity. Yeah, so perhaps you can't talk about what? Crises, right? Crises, yes. Yes, and Jaime Andres.
In the human body, the brain is seen as coordinating the rest of the body. So if you look at it in the terms of society, who does Durkheim see as the brain control?
Who do you think?
Collective consciousness?
That's, you see, Durkheim has got a definite idea of as something that has a much more conscious. And the collective consciousness is almost unconscious. But there is something in society that Durkheim will say is regulating and controlling. Mimi. The state. That's the brain. The state. The state. So there the analogy sort of works, possibly. Possibly. All right. Beware of analogies. So it's going to, Durkheim's going to work wonders with this analogy, but beware, beware, beware. Okay. So all sorts of things. Crises, mobility, conflict, revolutions. These are difficult to express with this analogy. All right. Now, finally, well, not finally, we're going to fill this box in later. Restitutive law is the law that corresponds to organic solidarity. It is a law in which the breach of relations leads to sanctions. And what are those sanctions? What are those sanctions? What are those sanctions? In general terms, Serena. They restore the relations to what they were before. The idea is not to punish, to repair a collective consciousness, but to actually apply sanctions that restore the relations. Restoring relations. Restoring relations. Very good. Now we're going to talk much more about this restitutive law. It is indeed a law that corresponds to a society with a division of labor and specialization of parts. It is a law that, in a sense, regulates the relations among those parts. And when those relations are in some way impaired, the law intervenes to restore the relations as they were. Now we need a few examples. Any favorite examples of restitutive law? Yes, you are.
Natalie.
Natalie, very good.
Another Natalie.
Mediation
in divorce trial?
Mediation in divorce trial. What's going on there? Right, so it's two individuals, shall we say spouses, male, shall we say, and female for now. Who decides whether they're going to get divorced?
Well, that depends on the person.
It could be either of them.
Defining the crime.
Oh, now we're interesting. Ah, there's a crime involved.
Well, there could be.
Aha, ha ha. Now this is a very interesting. This is domestic law. What is the crime you're thinking of?
Well, he could have.
He always he.
I was gonna say he could have stolen her makeup.
He could have stolen her makeup.
And she could have gotten really mad and said, I want
to. Wow. Women, do women respond that way to selling makeup? Okay. Yes. You know, it's a very interesting story. Divorce is very, very interesting. Before you were born, and before some of your parents were born, before 1970, if you wanted a divorce, male or female, what did you have to do? Anybody, any idea, Katie?
Did you have to get permission from
another
person?
No, you definitely did not have to get permission. You had to be, yes? All right, that would be great. If you could show that the other partner had committed adultery or had deserted you, and under those circumstances, you would go to the law courts, you would have lawyers on either side, and they may battle away as to whether you are guilty of a crime. Guilty of a crime, Natalie. Guilty of a crime, adultery. Violating the sanctity of marriage. Before 1970. Okay. So at that time, you might say the divorce law was what sort of law?
A repressive
law. In which you punish the guilty party. And indeed, what would happen is one partner who wanted to have a divorce would actually have people follow the other partner around to see whether they have any evidence for having violated the marriage code and thus committed a crime that would justify divorce. It was a long, elaborate, combative process, but what was at stake was the sanctity of marriage. That was part and parcel, you might say, of the collective consciousness. And we still have it, what they called family values. So, that was before 1970. It was a crime against the collective consciousness. After 1970 was introduced in California, no-fault divorce. Then, Natalie speaks. Because then, anybody can decide to get a divorce. And you have an agreement. You want to divorce your husband. Okay, you say, let's divorce. And they have a discussion, and they quietly figure out. And the conditions of the divorce, it's not to find somebody guilty. But what happens in proceedings? You must all know. What happens in the proceedings today of divorce, Christina? Oh. Right. So that's the function of alimony. But what happens to basically the resources in the marriage, in the family, in the marriage? How are they distributed, Katie?
They get divided.
They get divided in order to, in some sense, create the situation as it was before. And then there's a discussion of what resources matter. And of course, women may have been spending all their time at home, and do they have a share in the resources accumulated by the male who goes off to law school and becomes a corporate lawyer? Yeah, interesting question. This is not now an issue of violating some element of the collective consciousness and finding somebody guilty, but it is a matter of redistributing resources to, as best one can, restore the situation as before, given that they will be separated. In the old days, who looked after the children in a divorce, after a divorce?
Women.
It was a preservation of the gendered stereotype of motherhood, right? Today, well, we know it can move backwards and forwards, and men can actually be given custody of children. There's an amazing, amazing switch from it being a part of repressive law to restitutive law. You don't feel like a criminal if you are getting divorced today. When before, there was an element of being a criminal. Somebody had committed a crime. Now, the interesting question, of course, is why was there a change? This is where you need your sociological imagination. Why was there a change from repressive law to restitutive law in relationship to the family? Natalie. Yes, that might be a Durkheimian thing. Things changed in the collective consciousness. But why did they change? Why did they change? Was there anything going on in society that might have led to the change, Amanda? Where? In the whole society or in the family?
In the family.
Uh-huh.
And as that shifted, that there was a need for all family members to work together to produce a living on a farm or a factory or what have you, there led to more of a disability to have more.
Right. So one way to think about this is that women are entering into the labor force. Yes, the change in the law is a bit of a lag, because they are obviously entering the labor force in the 50s and 60s. But the fact that they're entering into the labor force, then there is a division of labor emerging in the family, and the family is ever more connected to the wider society, needs to be regulated. So it's rather than a separate entity that has characterized by mechanical solidarity. Yes, very good, yes. Yes, that naturally would explain on a more material way why the shift might have taken place in the collective consciousness vis-a-vis the family. Though, of course, today we have a backlash against that, the reassertion of family values and the family as a sacred entity. Yes, so it's a struggle still. I saw a hand. No? Yes? Okay. Yes, Andrew? Ah. Well, I think, well, Amanda should do it, but I'll do it. Basically, we're talking about the women entering into the labor force. And as they enter into the labor force, the family gets ever more connected to society and, in a sense, becomes more as a part that is interdependent with the whole. And within the family, there is more division of tricky stuff, this, isn't it? Shit. yes. Within the family, there is a new division of labor, and in a sense, there is an interdependence among men and women, since both are male and female. It's very tricky. Sociology is very tricky. Yes, yes. What we're trying to argue is that as women enter into the labor force, there is the character of the family, internally and externally, becomes much more strongly associated with the division of labor. Whereas before, the family was this solidary entity that was united by a strong collective consciousness. As the division of labor develops and as family gets connected, the collective consciousness gets weaker in the family and the division of labor more flexible, and so we get a shift in the law. Christina, did you write a paper on this? Two paragraphs. Interesting. Mimi? Yes, well, that's what we'll see, that families, that parts of society have their own sort of collective consciousnesses, sort of segmental collective consciousness. This room has its own collective consciousness.
Doesn't that get in the way of the big...
Well, that's a very good question. So you've got all these segmental ones, and then the question is, is there something that they all share, like individualism? That's right. No, it does actually dissipate the collective one, yes. Yes, question, yes. Yeah.
I also think, like, sometimes some of them might slowly be getting more money or more wealth or power. And by having that, they have more say in the time.
Very good. Very good. Very good. Very good. Very good. And therefore... More reciprocal, so we have a more organic solidarity, right? Yes. Yes. And in fact, what Durkheim is going to say is that organic solidarity, division of labor produces organic solidarity only when there's an equality between partners. And so you can see this even in the family, you know. In the old days, there was something called wife beating. And then it became something called battery. And so it became, in a sense, more the state get involved in regulating relations. Women have more say. Division of labor in the family became something that was much more negotiated. Yes. All right. I've got to move on. Angelina, last person. I'd have to think about that. I don't think there's any inherent law. I mean, he doesn't have much to... What he says in the beginning, of course, men and women are essentially the same, and then they differentiate. But, of course, they don't differentiate in single, what you're saying in a single way. It's not that just women are engaged in affective activities and men are engaged in intellectual activities. There is a... Basically, gender becomes less and less important in slotting... Less and still important, but less and less important in slotting people into the broader division of labor. Yes, yes. You know, let me give you a... That's complicated. Who started with... Natalie, did you start that? It's your fault. All right. Guilty, as charged. Yes. Now, the simpler one. Traffic tickets. Anybody ever had a traffic ticket here? Okie dokie. Now, is this repressive law or restitutive law, violating traffic laws? It's both. It's both, Hugo. Tell me about this. Brake light missing. Okay.
It was out.
It was out. Okay.
So I got what it's called a fix-it ticket.
A fix-it ticket.
Yeah. So I.
That's restorative.
Yeah, exactly. And so I took it down to the CHP, and they just double-checked and then marked me off.
Okay. All right. That's restitutive or restorative. Actually, it's not clear what relationship you're restoring, except your relationship to your light. But nevertheless, yes. That's right. What are the laws? What happens to traffic laws? Okay, Mario, what?
That's not restorative.
Uh-huh.
It's not restoring anything.
Very good.
All it's doing is causing for you to pay the state money.
Restoring the state, it's called. Very good. Okay, let's have another. Traffic. Anybody been in traffic school? Yep. Oh, hands go way up. Yes. Goalie, tell me what happens in traffic school. You had your hand up?
Yeah.
What happens? What did you do?
I paid somebody to do it for me.
Cool.
Now you can see why we got such weak solidarity in this society. That's very interesting. You paid somebody to do it for you.
How much did
that? How much?
75.
75. Is there an army of people who do this? There's a specialized function in society?
That was her job.
That was her job. Wow, fascinating. Ali, you're shocked.
I'm shocked because I didn't even think about that.
You didn't think about that.
I sat there.
It's a contractual relationship with somebody else to actually fulfill the restitution of a relationship. And that really messes Durkheim up. Anyway, of course, in principle, going to traffic school is, in a sense, trying to restore your relationship with other people who drive in the streets. And it's a clearly, so it would be a classic case of restitutive law.
What about EUIs?
Under influence. I don't do that. What is it? Where did we start with? It was Hugo, right? Yes. Yeah. You started with your brake light. So now we're on to drunk driving. Yes. So is that restitutive? Is there what happens there? Yes. Both. Zach. Yes. You don't drive while drunk, but perhaps even you shouldn't get really drunk. That's also something in the collective consciousness. There are societies where people spend time being drunk, but not in this one. We're supposed to be doing working. So there may be something about drunkenness and the danger it imposes on others.
So you have jail time, you go for a long time, and the message, and it goes beyond just your story.
Ah.
It actually goes on for longer of your life. And then I said restitutive law would be something like, for work, for example, you have to have a 10-minute meal break or a 30-minute meal break.
Get back to work. Yeah. Restore your relationship to your fellow workers and management. Yes, very good. Very good. Yes. That's right. Right. Good. Well, all right. So you're already writing your papers on this. Yes, very good. So there are many examples, therefore, of laws that actually contract law. It's all about restoration, administrative law, even procedural, how the law courts are supposed to work. This is the coordinating of the relations among different parts of society, administrative law, procedural law, constitutional law. So these are laws that are there to regulate relations among individuals or relations of parts. Yes. Well, I was going to talk about. I can't resist it. O.J. Simpson trial. I know you. It was such an extraordinary thing. You know, the O.J. Simpson trial, which was 1994, at the time, was clearly the publicization. In this case, of a murder trial in which O.J. Simpson, this celebrity, had been charged with killing his wife as well as his wife's lover. Goldman was his name. They were divorced? Ex-wife? If you say so, Katie. Very good. All right. Ex-wife. And it was what was the guy? Somebody Goldman. Anyway.
Ronald Lyle Goldman.
Okay, very good. Did it say ex-wife there, Anthony?
Yes.
Very good. Then it's true. Okay. So it looked quite incriminating. O.J. Simpson had sort of done a very sort of celebrated race away from the cops and for LAPD. The trial was up and everybody was watching this trial, and the issues were, first, the racism of LAPD, had they planted evidence against O.J. Simpson? Then there was the issue of gender relations in the family, sexual violence, harassment, of which there seemed to be a lot of evidence against O.J. Simpson. And then there was, of course, the issue of class, that O.J. Simpson could afford to actually have the most expensive, sophisticated, well-equipped legal team. Anyway, so it looked as though he'd done it, more or less, seemed to many people, but actually, well, we'll come to that in a second, he was acquitted by the jury. So the complainants, actually, his ex-wife and Goldman, what was his ex-wife's name?
Nicole Brown,
very good. You really know this, very good. Well, still, it's in here, Nicole Brown, that's right. So anyway, they pursued a civil suit of what? Wrongful death. They basically wanted to be compensated for the, this is the families of the two, wanted to be compensated for the death of their family members. And actually, in that case, Simpson was found, well, not guilty, but was found that he had actually committed a wrongful death, because the evidence in a civil suit is less stringent than in a criminal suit. So it was interesting. I think he had to pay millions, $8.5 million in damages. Is that on the thing there? So it's an interesting story of a distinction between a criminal suit, a penal law, and restitutive law. The idea is wrongful damage, or some extent that money would be there to somehow restore as best one can relations as they were before. Though, of course, that would be pretty impossible with people being dead. Yeah. Yeah. And then the story is that about 5 years ago, O.J. Simpson was caught for robbery. And he's now for 33 years sentenced in jail. He's on probation, but still in jail. Yeah, it's extraordinary business. Yes, Nicolette.
I just wanted to make a comment about that, that I think that the families that sue for wrongful death, they're trying to get a guilty verdict.
That's, yes.
I don't think their intent is ever about the money, but especially if the person gets off in the criminal trial, that it's a way of getting closure.
Right. Yes, it is a way of getting closure. What I was trying to show is that there is a difference in these two types of laws, though in practice you're saying that one is a substitute for the other. But anyway, it's an interesting how you want to move from the repressive law to the restitutive law in the same case. And it doesn't quite work, and the fact that it doesn't work indicates that there really are different types of laws. You can't really talk about a restoration in the restitute in this case. Okay, very good. All right. Now, we have 17 minutes left to do with Spencer. Question, yes, you know. Yes, the end of Spencer. Definitely. Comes with Spencer. Any other questions? Okie dokie, okie dokie, mokey pokey. Yes, all right, Spencer, an Englishman. Oh, yes, I was going to talk about Trayvon Martin in relation to John. Oh, you can think about that. Yes, Spencer, look. Chapter 7, Book 1 is very famous in the Division of Labor. A fellow called Talcott Parsons, whose name I mentioned before, in a sense celebrated Chapter 7 of Book 1 and made it the centerpiece of Durkheim's ideas and why Durkheim was really so central to the canon. What is Durkheim doing in Chapter 7 of Book 1? He is criticizing a fellow called Herbert Spencer. And what is he saying to Spencer? Well, we're going to have 5 points. But essentially, what Parsons says in drawing on Durkheim's Chapter 7 is he is saying that those economists who see the world made up of markets and contractual relations are missing something profound and fundamental. For there to be a contractual relationship, a market relationship, there has to be underlying trust and there has to be regulation. Those economists do not, Parsons is saying, understand the importance of underlying trust in relations and the importance of regulating relations. And we might say today that economic sociology is based on Book 1, Chapter 7. It is all about the conditions of existence of markets. That's what economic sociologists do. Right? Absolutely. Thank you very much, Ben. Yes. Yes, yes, yes. And economic sociology is becoming ever more central to sociology. Indeed. All right. So, page 149. Let us start at the beginning. 149. Anthony, the third paragraph. Nope. Sorry, it's the fourth one. Since
it is spontaneous.
That's the idea of Solidarity for Spencer.
There is no need for any coercive apparatus either to produce it or to maintain it.
So since solidarity, unity, industrial solidarity is spontaneous for Spencer, there is no need for any coercive apparatus either to produce it or to maintain it. Mm-hmm.
Society has therefore no need to interfere in order to effect a harmony that is established of its own accord.
So those industrial relations of contract establish a harmony of their own accord.
Each man may maintain himself by labor, may exchange his products for the products of others, may give aid and receive payment, may enter into this or that combination for carrying on an undertaking, small or great, without the direction of society as a whole.
Right. So what Durkheim is going to be arguing against is Spencer's idea of the spontaneity of solidarity. He's going to say that interdependence by itself does not lead to solidarity. Does not lead to solidarity. Yes. So why does he say that? Well, this is point number two. If we turn to page 152, essentially what he's going to say here on page 152 in the new paragraph is that the pursuit of self-interest, economic self-interest, brings people into relations with one another, contractual and non-contractual, that are short-lived and therefore, in a sense, do not produce solidarity. Let me read to you. 152, new paragraph. Is this indeed the nature of society whose unity is brought about by the division of labor? I, this spontaneous solidarity based on interdependence. If this were so, one might reasonably doubt their stability, the stability of relations. For if mutual interest draws men closer, it is never more than for a few moments. It can only create between them an external bond. In the fact of exchange, the various agents involved remain apart from one another, and once the operation is over, each one finds himself again reassuming himself in its entirety. The different consciousnesses are only superficially in contact. They neither interpenetrate nor do they cleave closely to one another. Indeed, if we look to the heart of the matter, we shall see that every harmony of interest conceals a latent conflict, or one that is simply deferred. For where interest alone reigns, as nothing arises to check the egoisms confronting one another, each self finds itself in relation to the other on a war footing, and any truce in this perpetual antagonism cannot be of long duration. Self-interest is, in the fact, the least constant thing in the world. Today it is useful for me to unite with you. Tomorrow the same reason will make me your enemy. Thus such a cause can give rise only to transitory links and associations of a fleeting kind. We see how necessary it is to examine whether such is effectively the nature of organic solidarity. Now, as you listen to me reading that, you may be reminded of whom? Hands up. Angelina. You should think before you hand your hand up. Zach.
I saw antagonism's conflict.
Lenin. Interesting. Antagonism's conflict. Come on. Who does that remind you of, Andrew? Smith, who talks about these individuals pursuing self-interest? And what Durkheim is saying here, that this pursuit of self-interest in the marketplace through exchange, through barter, is not going to be enough to produce organic solidarity. Yes. And what he says on page 160, and what he says on page 158, and all over the place there, perhaps we should look at 160. He says, on 160, read it to me, Anthony, in the new paragraph, or from the top of the page, 2, 4, 6, 7, 8 page, 8 lines, the conditions.
The conditions for their cooperation must also be fixed for the entire duration of their relationship.
So if you're going to cooperate, or you're going to even compete with one another in a marketplace, you have to fix relations. Go on.
The duties and rights of each one must be defined not only in the light of the situation as it presents itself at the moment when the contract is concluded, but in anticipation of circumstances that can arise and modify it. Otherwise, at every moment, there would be renewed conflicts and quarrels.
Okay, good. So what Durkheim is saying here is in a contractual relationship, there has to be more than contract. There are non-contractual relations of contract. There are non-contractual relations of contract. That is to say, when a worker signs a contract with an employer, he or she signs the contract, and it says all sorts of things about conditions of work, but there is a lot that is not in the contract. Just the very willingness to participate in the workplace. There is a relationship of trust that underpins the contract. Yes. In my relationship to my devoted GSIs, we have a sort of contractual relationship, but there is also a set of non-contractual elements. Do you know what they are? Any idea? Here in the front row, anyone? What are the non-contractual elements of your relationship with me? See, they, and there, why do you not work to contract according to time? You're supposed to work for 20 hours, you work for 30 hours. Now, why do you do that?
Feelings of obligation.
Feels of obligation, of unity with me, sense of vocation, commitment to teaching, commitment to you. There's a whole series of things that aren't written in the contract. Anything else? Manuel?
At office hours, talking through things beyond anything written in the contract, and sometimes treat us to dinner.
See, that's not in the contract. Dinners are not in the contract. So once, and also there is perhaps, who knows, you better some relationship of mutual trust that underpins that contract. A sense of common devotion, common consciousness to, yes, to you, to teaching, yes. So anyway, I think if you think about the contracts you've signed or the work relationships you have been in, you will also appreciate that there are non-contractual elements of contract. And Durkheim, that's what he is saying. He's also saying that sometimes we have professions that have a morality of their own, and he talks about that on pages 172, 173, 174, that professions have a morality of their own, and teaching professions have a sense of perhaps vocation, which also imbues contractual relationships with elements of trust. So that's point number two. Self-interest is transitory, and therefore in the contract, there have to be non-contractual elements that underpin the contract. Yes. Point number three is that not only do contracts have non-contractual elements, but there are non-contractual relations. Society is not just made up of contracts, as Spencer implies, or that is what is the tendency. But in fact, in society, there are indeed all sorts of institutions that exist on a non-contractual basis. Institutions, you know, essentially, there are parts of the family that you might think of contractual, but essentially the family is not contractual. The state is not contractual. All sorts of organizations don't have a contractual character. This university is not an entity built on contract. Yes. Yes. So, what he says then is that as contractual relations expand, so do non-contractual relations. And those non-contractual relations, those institutions built on non-contractual relations have to be, in a sense, brought into connection with the rest of society in a division of labor. Yes. Yes. That, as these non-contractual relations of various institutions expand, those institutions have to be brought into a relationship with the wider division of labor. Wider division of labor. Yes, so you've got contractual relations expanding in the economy, but you have got sort of many spheres outside the realm of contractual relations.
And, but what does that have to do with the division of labor?
Well, the division of labor is this, in this context means the specialization of different parts of society.
Which is related to the contract.
Yes, all right.
Sorry, I'm not...
No, very good. I'm trying to do this too quickly. So you can say that here's the economy. There's contract. And what Durkheim is saying, there are all these other institutions that are of non-contractual character. And what is important, Durkheim is saying, is that all these institutions be, in some say, integrated with one another. And so he says, for example, about the family. He talks a lot about the family on pages 157, 158. Essentially what, for example, you know, recently in California, they introduced family leave. Well, a few years ago now. Actually, 10 years ago. So basically what the idea of family leave is, it was to allow people to actually take sick leave 6 weeks a year at 55% of your pre-tax earnings, which was very novel. It's totally, this country is so backward, it's not true. But anyway, for then, it was that time it was novel. The idea was, it was to adapt the family to the economy. And so what that will be a very Durkheimian move, to introduce laws that will actually integrate different parts of society into the wider entity. Yes. So, but anyway, the point that Durkheim is making is that there are spheres where relations are not of a contractual character, and those spheres have to be also integrated into the wider society according to this sort of organic analogy. All right, let me finish, because we have to get to the state, and we'll go over it again next time. That was point number three. The rise of non-contractual relations. Point number four is that, I've been talking about already, that contractual and non-contractual relations have to be regulated. And here you should read page 162. Because on page 162, which is where we'll begin next time, Durkheim says, for the relations among these parts to lead to solidarity, there has to be social justice. And for Durkheim, social justice means equalizing of power between institutions. He says that it's important for workers to be unionized, to strike, to remind managers how dependent they are upon workers. So he is in the business, remarkably, of equalizing power relations among the parts. Under those circumstances, division of labor will lead to solidarity. And finally, fifthly, with all this regulation of the non-contractual and the contractual parts of society, you see the state doing what? Expanding. The state becomes ever more important in regulating relations among parts of society. Spencer says the state's going to wither away. It is less and less necessary to keep society coordinated. Markets will do it by themselves. Durkheim says the state is going to expand and expand in order to regulate the relations among parts of society. It's inevitable and necessary for the state to expand. That, those are my 5 points, the 5 critiques of Spencer. Read pages 162, where he talks about the importance of social justice, and then 167 to 171, where he talks about the state. Shoo.